It's going to take some time. Then I won't keep you on the phone. Darren, I really appreciate the call. If I get anything else, I'll call you. I promise I won't forget about you out there in Spookland. This isn't Spookland. This is my condo. It's just me. Right. Albright hung up. Dom continued looking at the photos slowly and carefully. Ross was a good-looking guy, Dom had to admit. He had his own Wikipedia page, too, but Dom found an article about him in the Post that looked more reliable. He was 32. He was in Mensa, the organization for people with genius IQs. This article showed a picture of the man standing next to his mother, Emily Ross, and it identified her as an ex-U.S. ambassador and a long-time tenured professor at Georgetown who had recently retired and moved to the West Coast. Caruso focused again on Ethan Ross. He looked into his eyes. Are you the guy? Are you the fucker who got the Yacobees killed? Dom had no idea if Ross was responsible, but at the same time he had no other real suspects. On a whim, he looked up Special Agent Rigoberto Finn's mobile number on an FBI internal phone list. It was nearly 11 p.m., but he dialed it anyway. After enough rings to where Dom was certain it would roll to voicemail, a gruff and tired-sounding man answered. Finn. Special Agent Finn, I'm very sorry to bother you so late. This is Special Agent Caruso calling from D.C. After a couple of coughs to clear his throat, Finn said, Dominic Caruso? That's right. I'll be damned. The president's nephew. At your service. I remember you smoked that child killer down in Georgia a few years ago. Alabama, yes. Nasty business. That was a damn good shoot. What I would have given to be in your shoes just once in my career. Dom cleared his throat uncomfortably, not sure what to say. Finn asked, What can I do for you? I'm calling about Ethan Ross. I understand you boxed him this afternoon.
Yep. You working with Albright?
Dom waffled for a moment, looking for the least untrue thing he could say.
You know Darren. 11 p.m. and I just got off the phone with him. I'm doing a little follow-up on Ross.
Yeah, that Albright's a ballbuster. I'm still at the Hoover Building. He's got me filing reports from today's exams. I'll be back at NSC first thing tomorrow, boxing another group of staffers.
I hear you. About Ross, Darren said you liked him as a suspect.
Maybe not a suspect, but a person of interest for sure. Intelligent as hell, I could read that off of him instantly. But he was gaming the shit out of me.
You sure about that?
I told Albright and I'll tell you. Ethan Ross went into that exam ready to obscure all relative physiological indices. People don't go to that much trouble just for kicks. I don't give a damn what the box says about the results. I had to mark it down as inconclusive, because Ross did a good job hiding his deception, but I'd bet my soon-to-be-relevant and insufficient pension that he was hiding something significant.
Dom thanked Finn for his time,
and he hoped like hell the examiner would have no reason to mention this phone call the next time he spoke with Special Agent Albright. Then he hung up. Dom next decided to spend the rest of the evening planning his one-man operation to look deep into the life of Ethan J. Ross. 19. A steady sleet hissed on the streets of Georgetown, but Ethan jogged right through it. Anyone looking out a row house window or driving by on this early morning would surely think the man in the orange windbreaker an exceptionally dedicated runner. But the truth was quite different. Rising an hour early to run through the streets had been hell on Ethan this morning, and now traipsing through sleet that burned his eyes and cheeks seemed insane. But he told himself he had to make the pre-dawn check of the green fire hydrant on Wisconsin. He could have driven by, of course,
but it would have been completely out of character for him to do so. And even with zero real tradecraft training, Ethan knew that would have raised red flags in the unlikely event he was being watched. He passed the hydrant and saw no telltale mark from Banfield. He wondered if it could have washed off in the weather, but he thought that unlikely, as the hydrant itself was dry. He continued on, jogging up 29th and leaving no mark behind himself. Although he wanted to talk to Banfield and Bertoli about yesterday's polygraph, he decided to give it a day for things to quiet down before leaving a signal and heading back out to Fort Marcy. He continued alone through the sleet, lost in his thoughts. He was still apprehensive about the poly, even though he'd worked hard to convince himself he was just being paranoid. Even if Agent Finn had suspicions about his truthfulness, Ethan knew the best thing he could do for himself was remain calm and continue acting as if all was normal, both at home and at work. Finn had nothing. Albright had nothing. And if he just chilled out, Ethan told himself, he'd be fine. In an effort to play it cool, he'd had Eve over the previous evening. They'd gone out for dinner at a Korean barbecue in Adams Morgan, and then they returned to his place to watch a movie until heading to bed. Eve made it clear halfway through the movie she wanted sex, but Ethan begged off. Again, he wasn't in the mood. Eve was a little disappointed, but not too surprised. Ethan was normally the aggressor, but he'd seemed distracted lately. She spent the night, but went home early in the morning while Ethan was out on his run. Before she left, she brewed him a pot of coffee and pulled his cup out of the cabinet, staging it for him next to the coffee maker. On top of the cup, she left a post-it note with a heart on it that she drew with a Sharpie. Ethan returned from the run to the empty house, walked into his kitchen, crumpled the post-it, and tossed it in the trash. Then he poured himself a cup of coffee and headed upstairs to start the shower. At 8:40 a.m., he stepped out the front door of his Georgetown row house. By now, the clouds had moved on, and the sky was bright and blue. He buttoned his wool coat against a cold breeze as he descended the stairs and headed down to his Mercedes in the driveway. A moment later, he fired up both the engine and the stereo. He was in a rage against the machine mood this morning, so he selected a playlist on his phone and then rolled off down 34th Street in the direction of work. Dominic Caruso watched him go. He stood in a small grove of trees across the street in Volta Park, his hands in his pockets to protect them from the cold wind. His head and face were covered with a wool hat and a neck gaiter, and he wore gray coveralls and black sneakers. A white hard hat was tucked into the crook of his arm, and a small black backpack hung over a shoulder. He looked like a laborer who'd just climbed off a bus from one of the poorer sections of town, down here in Tony Georgetown to work on the roads or an exterior home remodel project. After Ethan Ross's Mercedes disappeared down the street with some sort of thundering rap music Dom couldn't identify blaring through its closed windows, he turned his attention back to Ross's home. 1598 34th Street was a narrow, whitewashed brick two-story row house with a driveway on one side and steps in front that led both up to the tiny porch and down to a basement entrance. It wasn't a large building at all, maybe 1,500 square feet or so, but in this ritzy neighborhood, Dom put its value at north of $2 million. Dom doubted the average NSE staffer would be able to swing a mortgage here, which meant Ross's wealthy mom was probably footing the bill. Dom didn't know if this guy was the traitor or not, but he'd already built up some biases against him. From his position in the neighborhood park, Dom could see the fronts of all the other row houses up and down the other side of 34th Street. He took a few minutes to make sure none had security cameras on their porches that were angled to pick up the sidewalk in front of Ross's property. He knew exactly where to look for them, and he found nothing that gave any indication that an approach of 1598 would be recorded for posterity by a neighbor. He then spent a few minutes analyzing several other crucial features about Ross's property and the neighborhood from his viewpoint here in the quiet little park. When he had all the intel he needed, he turned away, headed back up the street to Wisconsin Avenue. His mission for right now was to get out of the cold and to enjoy a leisurely cup of coffee. He wanted to make certain everyone in the neighborhood heading to work or to school this morning had cleared out, so he decided to time his entry for 10 a.m. Last night, after he got off the phone with Albright, Dom read through Ross's bio and CV and a few articles he had written for Foreign Affairs and other publications. He'd found nothing in his writings of note other than a bias against Israel, which wasn't at all uncommon in U.S. diplomatic circles. He then looked up Ross's name and birth date in a D.C. real estate records database and found his address in Georgetown, pulled up the neighborhood on Google Maps, and used Street View to virtually walk the area. This gave him a basic understanding of the layout and style of the buildings, and he was even able to use his computer to look over a fence in the side yard that showed him the rear of his target's property. Dom knew there was much Street View could not reveal. The map was not the territory, after all. But he also knew spending a few minutes on his tablet looking at the area was a hell of a lot safer than spending the time physically wandering the streets around his target location and climbing fences. No neighborhood watch busybody was going to call the cops on him while he sat on his couch looking at Ross's house virtually, even if he spent all night doing so. There was another program on Dom's computer that did much the same thing, although in higher detail. Eagle View Technologies had a satellite mapping service that was similar to Google Maps, but it had more coverage with higher resolution in places where Google Maps did not bother to provide data, which made it a great resource for military and intelligence purposes. Dom could have used Eagle View to research Ross's home, but for his needs, a view of a street in Georgetown, Google Maps was just fine. Dom appreciated technological advances like this. His uncle had been a spy, sort of, back in the old days, the 1980s. Dom couldn't imagine what that was like, operating against the Soviet Union without a smartphone and worldwide satellite imagery. He thought it must have been exhausting. After spending a half hour on Google Street View and the property records search of Ross's home that gave him the basic layout, he decided he could, with some tradecraft and planning, pay a covert visit to Ross's home to look for more information. It was a decision he did not take lightly. After all, this was B&E, breaking and entering. 100% against the law, even for a guy with a badge that said he was FBI. But Dom was driven by the death of the Yacobies and the faint sense that he was on the scent of one of the people responsible for their deaths, and if the Bureau's best polygraph examiner suspected Ross was hiding something, Dom decided that was good enough for him to poke around into the man's affairs. Albright, on the other hand, would have to go through channels, which meant he'd have to jump through a maddening array of bureaucratic hoops. Dom told himself he'd dig into Ross a little, and if he turned out pure as the driven snow, Dom would back away quickly and discreetly. He'd be chastened by his impetuous behavior, but there would be no harm, no foul. On the other hand, if he found evidence that this White House wonder boy with the model looks and the multi-million-dollar house had anything to do with the deaths in India, then he knew exactly what he was going to do. Dom was going to ask Jerry for lethal authority to kill him. Ethan Ross got lucky with the traffic this morning, and he made it to work a little early, a rare enough occurrence that one of the security guards in the entrance shack to the Eisenhower building made a joke about him vying for a promotion. In his office, Ethan took off his coat, grabbed his waiting mocha off his desk, and stepped out into his secretary's office. He chatted with Angie for a few minutes, well aware of his need to appear cool and casual, and quite impressed with his ability to do so. Angie asked about the poly, and he remained relaxed, going into little detail, but assuring her it was nothing more than a nuisance. He actually got some work done in the first part of the morning. The National Security Advisor himself had an appointment in the Oval that afternoon, and Ethan's direct boss had sent him a couple questions to answer about a dispute in the Knesset that might or might not come up during the meeting. Ethan did some research in his files and on the Interlink TS system, and he called a colleague at CIA. He sent his answers back to his boss before 9:30 a.m. Everything was going smoothly today, and Ethan's feigned relaxed demeanor morphed into authentic composure as the morning wore on. He could see the light at the end of the tunnel. The FBI investigation would fizzle out in days, and this would all be behind him before he knew it. He took a long break after sending his work to his boss, grabbed a cup of coffee in the dining room, and chatted with some other staffers. Then he returned to his desk. He'd just sat back down when he heard Angie talking to someone out in her office, and he glanced up. There, just outside his door, stood FBI Special Agent Darren Albright. The FBI agent looked huge and menacing as he loomed in the doorway, his eyes locked on Ethan and his broad shoulders squared toward him. Ethan felt his head recoil, just an inch or two. He clenched the sides of his desk with both hands. What's going on? Was he under arrest? Was Albright going to tell him to stand up and turn around? Ethan relaxed a little when Albright said, "Don't get up." But Ethan stood on shaky legs anyway. The special agent said, "I just stepped in to see your secretary to check your schedule, wondering if you have time for a quick interview." "An interview?" "It's routine," Albright said, but the blank expression on his face remained, and Ethan read it as ominous. "You have a few minutes?" Ross then bent over his blotter to look at his agenda for the week. He kept his hold on the edge of the desk as he did so, worrying his hands would shake. "Actually, we'll have to do it another day. I'm taking the afternoon off. I'm out of here in a few." "Going somewhere?" "To the dentist," Ethan replied flatly, careful to hide any defensiveness. Albright did not blink. "This won't take but a minute." Ross looked back up from his blotter. He shrugged, a nonchalant gesture that he wondered if he had overbaked. "Well, I'm right in the middle." "5 quick minutes. Just a couple of questions." Fuck. He wished he'd taken Harlan's pills this morning. He should have taken them. Should have been ready for an impromptu questioning like this. He wouldn't sweat. The glycopyrrolate would last for several days. But he regretted not taking the mood-stabilizing meds. Ethan motioned to the chair in front of his desk, and he and Albright both sat back down. He folded his arms in front of him and put his elbows on his blotter. He pushed down hard into them, now virtually obsessed with the idea of avoiding displaying to Albright the anxiety he felt by exhibiting tremors. The FBI man pulled out a notebook and a pen, then began flipping through the pages, as if looking for something. "Your girlfriend." He tossed another page to the side and scrolled down some more. "Eve Pang." Ethan clenched his jaw and straightened his back slightly. "What about her?" "She is an information systems security manager at Booz Allen." "That's correct. Working, I see, on firewalled and VPN platforms." Ethan narrowed his eyes and looked over Albright's shoulder to a spot against the wall, as if he was thinking. "Not sure. We don't talk about work too much, but I think that sounds about right." Albright cocked his head. Ethan couldn't tell if he was genuinely surprised or playing a role. "You don't talk about work?"
"Not really."
"You got your BA in computer science, didn't you?" Yes. So you probably have a lot to talk about.
Not really. What she does is light years beyond my knowledge.
Albright smiled. Ross realized he'd never seen the man make the expression.
How would you know what she does if you two don't talk about work?
Well, I mean, I know in general what she does.
You do? How so?
Ethan felt his blood boiling. Albright's leading and provocative questions were quick and terse and designed to make him ramble, perhaps to incriminate himself. Ethan didn't know if all this was due to Finn's suspicions yesterday, or if everyone here on the third floor was getting the same treatment, but he felt genuine fear sinking into the pit of his stomach. Yesterday he'd had time to plan for his polygraph, and he'd been ready, more or less. This impromptu inquisition had caught him completely off guard. His mind raced with doubt and worry.
Why the hell did I tell him I could talk? Would it have looked worse to refuse to speak? What can I say to stop this interview right now?
Really, Special Agent Albright, I don't think it's appropriate for you to bring Eve into this. She doesn't even work here, and, I mean, it's only natural to discuss work. I talk about the job with my wife. General stuff, mind you, because she doesn't hold a security clearance. I would imagine Eve probably told you all about the unauthorized breach of the Ardahan files as soon as it happened 4 months ago. There wouldn't be anything wrong with that. You're cleared TS.
Albright went silent again. Ethan felt him trying to pull words out of his mouth. Ethan only shook his head slowly.
Another G is trying to get you to confess. Shut the fuck up.
Albright sat patiently. At last, and only to break an interminable silence that Albright seemed content to let last forever, Ross said no. She didn't say anything about it.
Of course she wouldn't, would she?
Wouldn't she? The two men looked at each other for a long moment in dead silence. Finally, Ethan said, no. Delvecchio said even though the breach was months ago, it was only identified after the attack in India last weekend.
Oh, right. That's correct.
Albright coughed and looked down at his notes, an affectation that made him look uncomfortable. My mistake.
Nailed him, Ethan thought. This son of a bitch thought he was going to win a battle of wits with Ethan Ross.
Bolstered now, Ethan said, "You are thrashing around, Special Agent Albright. I get it. You need to catch the culprit. I honestly hope you do, but you are barking up the wrong tree." Albright shrugged. His big shoulders heaved in his suit.
Maybe so. Maybe not.
Do I need to bring my lawyer into this?
Albright furrowed his brow like he was genuinely confused.
Your lawyer?
I don't know, Mr. Ross. I guess if you're in some kind of trouble, then yes, you might need a lawyer.
The room went silent again.
Albright let the tension build before he spoke. I'm going to interview Ms. Pang. You might want to take this opportunity to get out in front of anything she says.
Interviewer? She doesn't have anything to do with the network here.
Yes, but she has a lot to do with you. We won't box her, but we'll ask her about your conversations. If there was anything at all that she let slip in her pillow talk, anything that you might have used to facilitate the download of the Ardahan files, well, you won't be the only one in trouble.
That's outrageous.
What's outrageous is the fact that someone in this office, someone entrusted with classified information, violated that trust. It would also be outrageous if someone's girlfriend helped him, either wittingly or otherwise. She'd lose her clearance for certain. She'd lose her reputation. If I could tie an indictment onto her, I would do just that. Albright leaned forward. I'd drag her through the coals, just to fuck with the guy who betrayed his nation. Ethan kept a poker face. Is there anything else, Special Agent Albright? Albright nodded. That's right, you need to be running along so you can go get your teeth cleaned. And I assume you need to move off down the hall to the next office to try and scare Walter, and then move from him to Beth's office to terrify her. Interesting job you have. Must be a blast. The FBI man headed to the door, but he stopped, turned, and looked back. Actually, this part of the job sucks. But the best part, the part I fucking live for, is that moment when I mirandize some arrogant prick who thought he was gonna get away with it. Well then, I wish you luck with that. Albright said, yeah, see you around. And he left the office without another word. Ethan sat quietly for several minutes, his elbows still on the desk, pondering the conversation with the FBI special agent. Then he lifted his coat off the rack, grabbed his briefcase, and headed for the door. 20. Dominic Caruso returned to Volta Park at 10 a.m., and he stood behind a fence, watching 1598 34th Street Northwest on the other side of the road. He was still dressed in his gray coveralls, and now he wore his hard hat and his sunglasses. Dom fit into the fabric of the neighborhood perfectly. No one walking their dog or driving by would notice him at all, not that there was much automobile or foot traffic on the street at 10 a.m. on a Thursday. Most home break-ins happen in daylight because that's when people aren't home, of course, but there is also something about the middle of the day that causes natural defenses to diminish. People who look like they belong are rarely noted and almost never suspected. Dom crossed the street at the corner. Then he walked down to 1598, and he stepped onto the property as if he had every reason and right to be there. He took the steps down to the basement entrance, and here he stood shielded from the street and anyone who passed. Dom seriously doubted Ross had a tenant in a private apartment down here, but he knocked nonetheless, then rang the doorbell. When no one answered after a minute, he repeated the process upstairs, and only after he was certain no one was home did he go back down the steps and move around to the tiny narrow driveway. Next to the electric meter on the side of the house, Dominic found the telephone junction box. He used a screwdriver from his backpack to open the panel, and then he simply unplugged the outgoing phone line. If the security system had been wireless, he would have had more difficulties, but the little sign sticking out of a planter on the front stoop told him all he needed to know. This particular company did not offer wireless home security in this area, so Dom felt comfortable he could defeat the system with ease. He went back down to the basement entrance, where again he was invisible to the street. He did not pause. He did not second-guess himself. Instead, he pulled a lock-picking set out of his backpack, knelt down, and went to work. He defeated the old door's deadbolt and knob lock in 80 seconds. He opened the door extremely slowly. Immediately, the burglar alarm began chirping. This notified the homeowner that he or she had 60 seconds to disarm the alarm before it sounded, and under normal circumstances, contacted the monitoring station. But Dominic had prevented the outgoing call, so the alarm was more an annoying noisemaker than a security device. He kept his shades on and his helmet low on his head as he entered the house, still holding on to the door and moving at a glacial pace. At this stage, he was on the hunt for motion detector cameras, the type Ross might have attached to his wireless router. These would work independently of the home security system. Dom pegged Ross as a techno buff,
He had a background in computers, after all, so he could easily set up his own enhanced home monitoring system using his wireless network. Dom walked slowly now. His entire body moved less than 3 inches a second, meaning each step through the house took 10 times longer than normal. Off the shelf, motion detectors were typically set to notice movement that tracked faster than 3 inches a second, so Dom and his teammates at the campus had spent many silly yet laborious hours of training to defeat motion sensors by walking through hallways like wind-up toys whose springs had sprung, giving them little energy for movement. This required patience and care. If Dom bumped something on a table here in Ross's home, if he dropped something out of a pocket, if he kicked something on the floor, or if he simply moved 1 inch per second faster than planned, the camera would notice him, and Ethan Ross would get an urgent text message on his phone alerting him to a disturbance at his home. A motion capture photo would be sent along with the text, displaying Dom in his residential construction worker getup, and real-time video would be recorded at a website run by the security camera's manufacturer. The alarm began sounding loudly throughout the house after a minute, but Dom ignored it, knowing it was a small risk anyone in the area would even hear it, a smaller risk anyone would call the police if they did, and an infinitesimal risk the police would show up in time to catch him in the act. He found what he was looking for 3 minutes after entry. He'd taken the stairs up to the main floor and entered the kitchen from a rear entrance to the hall. A small camera was on the kitchen peninsula and facing the living room and the front door. Dom approached the camera from behind, so he moved at a normal pace, and he simply flipped a switch on the back that turned it off. Free to move around the ground floor at will now, he found the locked security system box on the wall in the hallway and had it open in 10 seconds. He unplugged the alarm, stopping the shrill siren. He left the box open and the wire dangling from it while he resumed his hunt throughout the house for electronic eyes. He expected to discover another wireless security camera facing the back door, so he was not surprised when he found it overlooking a glassed-in back porch. But this cam was trickier than the first, because Ross had hidden it at the top of a pantry closet with a small hole cut through the door. He considered flipping off the entire wireless system in the house, but there would be a record of that in the router's memory. So after spending a minute trying to figure out how he could defeat the device without opening the door and triggering it, he simply decided to avoid the entire back porch altogether, even though in front of the camera's lens stood a wicker settee and a coffee table full of loose papers that appeared to contain some handwritten notes. Dom took the stairs to the second floor, where he found another motion detector, but this one was linked to the home security system and had therefore already been disabled. He looked at his watch. His breaching clear of the premises had taken 7 minutes, 12 seconds. For step 2, the security eval, he did a quick walk through the home, looking for evidence of a roommate who was not home but might return, a dog out for a walk with a walker, a live-in girlfriend who might pop home for lunch, kids who needed to be brought home from school early, or any indication that others came and went. From the closets, he determined Ethan lived alone, although it was clear 2 people had slept in the bed the previous evening. Dom knew from Albright that the man had a girlfriend, but the only photographs he found around the home were either of Ethan himself or of Ethan's mother. Next, Dom focused on the file cabinet in Ross's small home office. He thumbed through the meticulously indexed files until he found a tab that said, Home Security. He pulled out the file, shuffled through some papers, and located an index card containing the password for the system's key panel. He put the paperwork back where he found it, hurried downstairs, plugged the power back into the wall box, and shut the case. At the key panel by the front door, he typed in the password and disarmed the alarm, putting it in a dormant mode that would not activate if the doors were opened or closed.
Stage two was complete 12 minutes and 20 seconds after he entered through the basement door. Still looking at his watch, Dom felt he probably had several hours before Ethan would return from work, but he didn't have any information about a possible housekeeper, so he gave himself only 30 minutes to do what he needed to do inside the home. Now came stage three, the SSE, or Sensitive Site Exploitation. He began upstairs in the bedroom, where he found a mobile phone by Ross's bed, which surprised him. Most people have only one phone, and they keep it with them. For a brief, horrifying second, Dom worried Ross was still somewhere in the house, but the thought quickly disappeared as Dom realized he'd already checked every room at least once. This guy simply owned more than one phone for some reason. Dom checked the phone quickly for any telltales, anything Ross might have set up so he could know if it had been tampered with, then carefully confirmed the device was password protected. Yep. Damn. Pulling intel off the device would take hacking equipment Dom did not have, but finding this phone was not a complete strikeout. He looked it over closely and decided it was new. The buttons were stiff and the case was pristine. He then carefully opened the back of the phone with a small screwdriver and photographed the number on the SIM card. Dom knew, with the right equipment, the subscriber identity module number could be used to track the phone or trace its usage. He checked the living room next. It was rather stately for its small size, with high ceilings and antique bookcases. Dom set his phone to record video of everything out in the open, paying special attention to handwritten phone numbers, parking stubs, receipts, and other items that Ethan generated in his day-to-day life that might be able to attach him to either a person or a place. Dom spent the next several minutes looking through the waste paper baskets, thumbing through mail and receipts, and filming everything as he went. He didn't have time to go through everything, but this was exploitation, not analysis. When he got back home, he would feed the video file through analytical software that would identify, evaluate, and categorize words and numbers pulled from each image. Dominic filmed a stack of books on a shelf and a similar stack on the coffee table. Every last one of them had to do with computer security. Of course, Dom knew that Ross's girlfriend was a computer security expert, but these looked like textbooks, not something she would need, since she had earned her doctorate years ago. So they belonged to Ross? Was this guy a policy wonk, or was he a computer programmer? Dom realized he was looking for reasons to be suspicious of the man, and this proved nothing in itself, but it was at least a little curious. He kept searching. A MacBook Pro sat on the living room couch. Dom checked it quickly for any obvious tamper detection traps, such as a hair attached to the lid and base that would break if someone opened it. Just like with the phone, he found no telltales, which made Dom think Ross behaved just like most normal people, and he had mistakenly put his faith in a home security system that could be defeated by anyone with a screwdriver and a little knowledge. Dom opened the laptop and confirmed it was, in fact, password protected. He imagined there were answers to be found on the hard drive, but he didn't have the resources to uncover them. He thought about David and his promise for logistical support from the Mossad, but he couldn't think of a way to exploit the hard drive in the time he had to do so without Ross knowing someone had been snooping around his place. No, that wouldn't work. Dom would have to find clues somewhere else. 5 minutes later, he was back upstairs in Ross's office, flipping through the paper on his desk, then digging inside the drawers. In a file folder, he found a copy of Ross's clean title on a 2013 Mercedes-Benz E-Class coupe. Red. Dom took a picture of the VIN. If he could find it later, either here at Ethan's house or in a parking lot near the Eisenhower building, He would attach a slap-on GPS locator under the bumper so he could then track the vehicle with an app on his phone. On a whiteboard on the wall by the desk, Don saw Ross had written a few notes to himself, and he sucked these up into the video recording. His watch chirped, alerting him he had 10 minutes remaining of his allotted 30. He went downstairs for a quick check of the kitchen, and here he looked through drawers and cabinets and at cans and jars. He recorded matchbooks, pens, and notepads with logos, even the names and vintages of the wines in his wine rack. He found small plastic pill bottles in a drawer, and they stood out because, unlike most prescription medication, there were no markings on any of the bottles. Inside each, he saw several pills, with each bottle containing pills of a different color and shape. Dom photographed them carefully, and then put them back where he'd found them. He had just started to check for trace markings on a blank notepad attached to the refrigerator when he heard a noise, like a footfall, on the small brick porch outside the front door of the row house, just 25 feet from where he now stood. He was understandably startled at first, but within a half second he deduced it must have been the mailman. Don stood there for a moment, watching the mail slot, expecting his assumption to be confirmed, when a stack of letters and ads fell to the floor. While he watched, he reached over and flipped back on the wireless security camera covering the entrance and the living room. But just as he flipped the switch, Dom heard the unmistakable and panic-inducing sound of a key sliding into the lock of the front door. The door latch clicked instantly, and a shaft of light from outside raced toward him along the hardwood floor. 21. Dominic dropped flat on his chest in the kitchen behind the peninsula, shielding himself from the entryway. He spun himself around to face the doorway at the back of the kitchen, which led to the hallway that ran along the northern side of the first floor. He began pulling himself forward with his hands so his sneakers didn't squeak on the polished floorboards, using his cotton coveralls to slide silently. Behind him, he could hear the front door close and someone in the living room walk over to the wall security system keypad and punch a couple buttons. A male voice muttered, "What the fuck?" Dom suspected this was Ross, and he'd obviously just noticed the security system was disarmed, meaning either someone had changed it, or else he had forgotten to set it this morning when he left for work. Dom kept pulling himself across the floor, slowly but surely. While he did so, he thought Ross would have to be either incredibly switched on or a complete obsessive compulsive to have no doubts he had remembered to alarm the system. There was an entrance to the hallway to the back stairs from the living room, and another from the back of the kitchen. Dom hoped like hell Ross would bypass the kitchen altogether, but he heard the creaking footfalls on the hardwood as Ross began moving in his direction. Dom picked up the pace, moving along the floor. He kept his legs up and pulled himself with his forearms, using the low friction of the slick surface to slide along on his chest and hips. It took all his upper body strength to accomplish this, and doing so without grunting with effort was difficult. He pulled himself into the hallway out of view, and he'd just kicked his legs out of the kitchen when the kitchen light snapped on. Ross was just 15 feet behind him at the light switch, and very possibly still heading his way toward the stairs up to his bedroom. Dom launched to his feet and moved straight back down the hall, making his footsteps as soft as possible and doing his best to keep them in perfect cadence with the louder steps of Ross behind him. Dom passed the staircase on his left and ducked through the open doorway of a tiny laundry room on the right. The dark space was barely enough room for a stacked washer and dryer, but Dom pressed himself hard against the appliances to stay out of view from up the hall. He heard keys dropped on a counter, and the footsteps behind halted for an instant. But then they started up again. Looking directly ahead, Dom could see the stairs in front of him. If Ross climbed the stairs,
He would only have to glance down and to his right to see a man in gray coveralls and a white hard hat leaning back into his washer and dryer. Ethan Ross entered the hallway on Dom's left and began climbing the stairs. Dom pushed himself against his backpack with all his might, backing himself up another inch or two. He was furious for allowing himself to get into this compromised and dangerous position. He had a pistol in a shoulder holster under his coveralls, but he wasn't about to pull it. So far, Dom had enough evidence to suspect Ross only of being a rich mama's boy. If Ross saw him, Dom could do little more than run for the front door. Ethan climbed the stairs toward the second floor, slowly and distractedly, in great contrast to his movements since leaving his office a half hour earlier. He'd all but raced home, intent on getting in touch with Banfield and Bertoli as soon as possible, but this all changed the moment he entered his house and tried to turn off his home security system, only to find it had already been disarmed. He was out of it today. Not nearly as confident as he needed to be, but he couldn't believe he hadn't armed the security system before he left this morning. He thought back, and was nearly certain he remembered doing so, but he had to admit to himself that, despite his sharp intellect, for mundane, repetitive tasks, it wasn't hard to get one day confused with the next. Ethan pushed the alarm system out of his mind as he headed into his bedroom, and immediately he returned to his main worry. Special Agent Darren Albright. Ethan had left work shortly after Albright left his office. He wasn't concerned about appearances. He told Angie he was heading out for lunch before his dentist appointment and would be gone for the rest of the day. And although he was certain she'd heard at least part of his conversation with the special agent, he knew Angie wouldn't suspect him for an instant of being a whistleblower. He changed out of his suit and then stepped into his closet to grab a pair of jeans and a cashmere sweater. All the while, he thought about how he would get in touch with Banfield. He had to be sharp now, sharper than he'd obviously been so far. Making contact with Banfield without using the fire hydrant signal was a danger, of course, but he thought it so important now it was even worth risking a phone call, although he knew he had to use some sort of code in case either he or Banfield was under surveillance. When he was still in the process of getting dressed, he picked his home phone out of its cradle by his bed, then brought it to his ear. As he did so, he noticed the mobile Banfield had convinced him to purchase a few days earlier, and it occurred to him it would be foolish of him to use his landline to make the call. He cradled the home phone and snatched up the mobile. While he dialed the number with one hand, he struggled to pull his head through his cashmere sweater. Directly downstairs, Dominic slipped off his sneakers, then tied the laces together quickly so he could hang them around his neck. In his stocking feet, he scooted along the floor of the downstairs hallway so as to stay as quiet as possible, and he moved to the back of the house. He entered the covered porch. He was in front of the lens of the security camera in the pantry, but he knew it wouldn't matter now that Ross was home. The wireless camera wouldn't send an alert to his phone if his phone was connected to the same network, because it would know he was home. Dom first planned to make his way out the back door, climb the fence, and clear the scene. But the fact Ross was home gave him an opportunity Dom could not pass up. He took a knee by the messy coffee table on the closed-in porch, and he recorded all the paperwork there with the video function of his camera phone. He found more papers in a magazine rack next to the couch, and this he pulled out and sifted through quickly, careful to record each sheet. While he worked, he kept his ears tuned to the footfalls directly above him. He could hear Ross moving into and out of his closet, and then he heard a muffled voice. It was only Ross speaking, so Dom presumed he was talking on the phone.
Don didn't know if he was using the mobile phone by the bed or another mobile, but he sure as hell wasn't using the landline in the house, because Dom had disconnected the wire in the box outside. Dom couldn't make out anything said until the very end of the one-sided conversation, when Ross all but shouted, his voice agitated, "I mean today! Right the fuck now!" Dom thought this sounded highly suspicious. He finished his work on the porch and headed for the door. It had a serious exposed slide lock and a massive deadbolt. Dom unlocked the deadbolt, but just as he reached for the sliding lock, he jerked to a stop. Behind him in the hallway came the sound of creaking stairs. Ethan Ross was on his way down. Shit! On the other side of the back door was a screen door, and Dom imagined it would be a noisy proposition to open this in a hurry. He turned away from the exit and scooted in his stocking feet back to a hallway closet by the entrance to the porch. He pushed himself inside, hiding behind the array of thick coats hanging there. He just needed a place to stay out of sight until Ross left the house. He'd peeked in the closet earlier, and now he decided it was his best possible option. But Murphy's Law kicked in. He heard Ross's shoes squeak on the hallway floorboards when he turned at the stairs and began walking in Dom's direction. Dom realized Ross was heading for this very closet. Dominic rolled his eyes, pushed his backpack hard against the wall, and fought the urge to yank his Smith & Wesson out of his shoulder holster. The closet door opened. Dom remained pressed flat against the cedar back wall. He didn't move a muscle, and he held his breath. Ross fumbled with his coats for what seemed to Dominic to be an eternity. He yanked out a suede riding jacket, then put it back in favor of a camel wool three-quarter length coat, and then finally he settled on a high-tech red North Face synthetic down ski jacket. When he pulled it out, Dom was exposed at the back of the closet, but Ross had already turned away. He shut the door and headed toward the front of the house, and Dom blew out a long, silent sigh. As Ross entered the living room, his mobile phone rang. Dom heard him answer, and he managed to pick up the majority of the conversation because Ross's voice carried down the hallway. "Hey, Mom." "No, I left early. I told you, dentist appointment. Taking the rest of the day off." Next came some grumbling from Ross that Dom couldn't understand. Then he said, "I'll do it later. I don't have time right now." After several more seconds of frustrated complaining, he said, "I'm walking out the door. It's up in my office. I'll call you later and..." A long hesitation and an almost childish sigh Dom could hear even through the closed closet door. "All right. Wait a minute." Dominic heard Ross running back upstairs. He sounded annoyed and hurried. When Dom knew Ross had stepped into his second-floor office, Dom pushed his way out of the closet and walked in his stocking feet to the back door. There he carefully unlocked the wooden door and opened it, then slowly pushed open the screen door. As he suspected, it squeaked upon opening. But Ross was talking on the phone upstairs, giving his mother someone's name and email address. Dom walked through the tiny backyard, staying close to the wall of the house on the off chance Ross was looking out a second-floor window. He made it to the driveway, knelt to put his shoes back on, and then he turned to head around to the front of the property. Dom found the red E-Class parked in the drive. He reached into his backpack as he walked up to it, and he barely broke stride when he knelt down and placed a slap-on GPS receiver under the rear bumper. He reattached the phone line at the junction box, and then closed it up and moved toward the street. With a quick glance to the front door of the row house to confirm he was in the clear, Dom stepped out onto 34th and began walking north. As he headed away, he heard Ross open and then shut his front door. Dom didn't look back. Even when the Mercedes pulled out of the drive into the street and screeched off to the south, again with heavy music blasting from its speakers, Dom relaxed for the first time in an hour. He didn't think he'd gotten much for his troubles, but he had collected some data he could analyze, and he had a way to see where Ross was heading. He suspected he was not going to the dentist. Whoever he was meeting with, Ross seemed to think it was an emergency. Tom wouldn't try to track him to his meeting. It was too risky. Instead, he decided he'd go home and sit at his laptop to watch Ethan's movements in real time while he loaded all the data he'd picked up into the analytical software. 22. Ethan found himself back in Fort Marcy Park for the third time in 4 days. He hadn't driven here himself. Instead, he'd parked his car in a lot near Washington Circle, and from there he took a cab into Arlington-Shirlington. He walked through the village at Shirlington, an upscale outdoor mall, then caught a bus that took him to within a half mile of the park, and he went the rest of the way on foot. The long transit wasn't his idea. Harlan Banfield instructed him to take a circuitous route during their brief phone conversation, after first telling him to leave his primary mobile phone at home. This all seemed like a lot of silly spycraft to Ethan. He'd looked over his shoulder several times and hadn't noticed anyone tracking him. But Banfield had insisted, and the old newspaper man seemed like he knew what he was talking about. So Ross reluctantly tossed his main phone on his bed, took his new phone, and left his house to begin something Banfield dramatically referred to as a dry-cleaning run. He'd run around for 45 minutes. It was the noon hour now, and as soon as he walked into the park, Ethan saw that he and his collaborators would not have the place to themselves as they had on their earlier meeting. In addition to Banfield's Volkswagen, several other vehicles were parked in the little lot, and Ethan saw men and women eating sack lunches behind the wheel of their cars. A school group of 25 or so fourth graders skittered around the Civil War-era gun emplacement, led more or less by a teacher and a park ranger, and a young couple wearing military fatigues. After all these years in the NSC, Ethan still had trouble distinguishing the different branches by their utility uniforms, walked hand in hand on the trail. For a moment he worried that everyone in the park, with the possible exception of the fourth graders, was working for the FBI and was here only to catch him in the act. But he pushed this out of his head. He didn't have anything incriminating on him, and Banfield had told him he'd wave him off if he didn't feel comfortable with their level of privacy when he arrived. Banfield and Bertoli stood by the cannon, in the exact same spot he saw them standing in before. Ethan looked for a signal from Banfield. He had a newspaper under his arm that he would drop to the ground if he wanted Ethan to pass them by and keep walking, but he kept the paper under his arm as Ethan approached. Banfield spoke as soon as Ross was close. "Do you absolutely know you weren't followed?" "Of course I don't know. I mean, I don't think so. I didn't notice anyone, but I'm a White House policymaker, not some low-rent private detective."
Bertoli waved the worry away.
"What has you so upset today, Ethan? The polygraph?"
Ethan said the poly seemed to go okay, but the examiner asked me if I was taking medicine to keep me from sweating. Banfield winced. With a grave expression, he said, "You told him no, of course."
"Of course I did. But I don't think he bought it."
"Might just be a fishing expedition," announced Banfield, but Ross couldn't tell for sure if he believed it. "And then today, Special Agent Albright. He just showed up and questioned me over and over. I asked if I needed to lawyer up, and he backed off, but they are suspicious. At least, I think they are." He ran his hands through his blonde hair.
"I mean, shit. I don't know. Maybe I'm just losing it."
Banfield said they might be doing this to everyone who had access to the file.
"Maybe.
But he said he was going to interview Eve to see if she might have told me about techniques in passing that were used in the Peace Flotilla download. She would never betray me intentionally. But Albright is good. He could twist her up. Get her to say something that makes him more suspicious. The three of them stood quietly in the park for a moment, weighing the situation. Banfield said, "We can find out if you really are a person of interest.